This episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is brought to you by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. You can find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 52. Sherlockian Mythbusters.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Walder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hello, and welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Walder.
And a better time is what we wish you and what we hope you end up saying that you ended up with after spending a little bit of time with us.
Yes.
That could be debatable, though.
No.
Well,
I always enjoy it.
I don't know about you.
We specialize in certainty here.
Well, I like the positive thinking.
Yes.
Well, it's been a little while since we've spoken last. We're trying to keep a little bit more regularity rather than irregularity, although one would expect irregularity out of a couple of Baker Street irregulars out of our show. But since we spoke last, our last episode, episode 51, was all about, what was it about? Boy, 51. I'm thinking about, who can be a Sherlockian? Who is a Sherlockian? A little bit of a debate. Actually, I don't listen to all of our shows. I obviously listen when we're talking and when we're interviewing.
Well, you know,
people.
That actually explains a lot now that you
mentioned. Yeah. But I don't go back and actually listen to every show that we post, with very few exceptions. And I did listen to this one because I thought, you know what, there were some controversial topics in there, and I wanted to make sure that we struck the right balance. We did want to give fair, kind of fair shake to sides and whatnot. And I went back and listened, and you know, it ended up being what I thought was one of my personal favorite shows that we've done.
Yeah, well, I think it was one of my favorite shows as well. I do listen to most of our shows, always hoping that they'll end differently. But you know, for some reason, it's always the same. I'm always, you know, encouraged and vaguely optimistic. No, but I think it was one of our better shows. We covered a lot of grounds, and we were both clearly passionate about our particular points of view, and we got a lot of good feedback. And in fact, we got some correction. You know,
yes,
we should probably address the correction. You know, the point. And what I'm thinking about, Scott, is the point that we made in the gas lamp.
Mm-hmm.
Our friend John Lullenberg pointed out the actual circumstances surrounding Edgar's commentary about Baker Street irregulardom. And John pointed out that this was also well documented in his irregular history of the 1940s. Do you happen to have that note from John?
Yeah, I do. He's referencing irregular crises of the late 40s. He recommends taking it off of your bookshelf, and you all, of course, have the BSI archival history. If you don't, it's still available. You can actually go to bakerstreetjournal.com and take a look there. I think the late 40s was one of the volumes that was still available in print. John references pages 130 to 143 to discover exactly, with regard to Edgar Smith's, who is a Baker Street irregular. John said that it was not Edgar's finest hour. And of course, it was the organization was trying to sustain itself financially. Ben Abramson was trying to recoup his significant investment in the Baker Street Journal, which was overproduced both in scope and in scale. So that the journal itself, and if you've ever seen those old series BSJs, they were lavishly produced. They were thick. They were perfect bound. They were, just numerous in pages and glossy pages as well as newsprint. And I think they printed about 3,500 copies of each issue, which was way more than the number of Sherlockians out there. Mm. So I think Edgar was trying to get people to subscribe to not only the journal, but to Irregularity as well. And, we appreciate that that sentiment, John, and checking the facts against the history in the BSI archival history is certainly a great way to go.
Yes, but I think John's, I think the basic fact there was, A, that Ben Abramson printed too many of these things, so he was a couple of thousand dollars in the hole, and that was big money at the time, and therefore subscribe to the journal and become an irregular as a promotion was designed to ease that financial burden. But B, John pointed out that that mightily offended irregulars at the time, who believed that their being a member of the organization and their being invited in and their being invested or investitured was a worthy distinction, unlike being simply designated a member of the organization if you subscribe to the publication. And so this led to some sore feelings.
Oh, so he means that they thought they were elite devotees. Right? Which the point of selecting that very gas lamp and the words that Edgar used, we were able to take some editorial license with that because it proved our point.
Yes. Yes, well, there is that. But, I don't know that they thought of themselves as elite devotees.
I'm obviously playing a little bit with the comment with what our topic was last time. Yeah. But one could see, if this is an organization, whether it's tongue-in-cheek or whether it is a mighty literary institution, those people that have been afforded membership through, certainly in those days, proving oneself, and the crossword puzzle that the Morley brothers put together was one way of doing that. These were, and they were men at the time, these were men who believed that they had achieved some level of recognition. And I think that still holds true today to a certain extent, that the BSI is, I won't say it's highly sought after, but it is recognized by most in the field that it is an accolade that is granted on one. It's not the only way to play the game, and it's not the only accolade one can get, but it is one distinction. And I think by granting that distinction to everyone, you suddenly debase the value of the entire monetary system, if you will.
Yeah, well, I think so. But, I do think, as you pointed out a minute or so ago, that's really sort of unconnected to the elite devotee notion. I mean, elite status, we should get to the user, we should get to the feedback that we got, and not to restate the whole debate, but basically, when you travel a lot, you become a frequent flyer, and so you get a special carpet to step over before you get on your plane, and you get a fast route through airport security and so on, because you are an elite person. And the idea that you would be an elite devotee because of your demeanor, because of your word choice, because of your thoughtfulness, because of your wardrobe— is hard to connect, at least for some of us, at least for you and I, to irregular dumb or to the enthusiasm of an interest in the life and career of Sherlock Holmes and Conan Doyle.
Yeah. And before we do get to those listener comments, because there were quite a few, I think we struck a chord with people with this topic. I wanted to mention one thing that I forgot to mention last time as you were reading a little bit of the Elite Devotee Redux, and that had to do with the wardrobe. And the quote that you mentioned from what was written mentioned sport coat and tie. And I thought, peculiar.
Suit and tie, I think.
Yeah. Suit and tie, yeah, sport coat and tie. That's peculiar because that would intimate that women aren't necessarily included as part of this elite group.
What? You mean girls?
Yeah.
You mean females? Good God.
Next thing you know, we'll be allowing them to vote.
Good God.
Yeah, it just seemed to it stood out for me. And I know that the point was not that, well, I don't know if you remember Wayne and Francine Swift.
Yes, of course.
Of the BSI, longtime members of the BSI. Wayne and Francine, of course, members of the BSI. They were active members in the Sherlock Holmes Society of London. I know they participated in the Silver Blaze races quite frequently. Wayne, in fact, wrote the 2000 Baker Street Journal Christmas Annual that looked at the history of the Silver Blaze race. Mm-hmm. But Francine always used to dress in jacket and tie.
Well, she was an elite devotee.
She evidently was. She had her BSI tie and she wore her sports coat and, you know, she hobnobbed it with the rest of them. So I guess it can be done.
Yeah, but this is a subject for a whole other podcast. and you know, as most irregulars know, and I think Bill Waterston and Calvin and Hobbes documented this reasonably well, the whole issue around girls is cooties, you know, that just doesn't mix with scotch and soda and your hearty old irregular scenario. But that's another. We have to get into that later.
Well, you know, one would think that scotch and soda would inoculate one against cooties. But,
well,
you know.
See, now we're going to need a pathologist. So now we're going to have to invite Bob Katz.
Well, Bob Katz will have to come back on.
Yeah. Yes.
By the way, I was looking at some of our statistics, and the podcast with Andy and Bob, episode 50, our golden anniversary episode, was actually our most highly downloaded episode yet.
Oh, hallelujah.
Yeah, yeah. So evidently they run in good circles, so that we'll have to invite them on again.
Yeah. That was a great conversation. Well, you know, it was good to, but that's interesting, and but I think it's because of the subject matter too. You know, the book, and
it was a good book. But you know, I think our interview shows are a lot of fun.
Yeah, they are.
And we've got some great guests on here who really bring a lot to it. And of course, we've got interview shows in the pipeline that we do plan on coming up with later this year. So stay tuned.
Yeah, we will. But I think that's true. You know, our show with Fritz Weaver, our show with Mike Derda. Those are among my favorites, I think.
Otto Penzler.
Yeah, Otto was great. Peter, Mike Whalen.
Yeah. Good. So why don't we get to the listener comments from episode 51. As we said, we did have a lot of feedback, and we've got, I think, about four or five emails we'd like to run through here, emails and comments and whatnot. The first one comes to us as a comment on iHearOfSherlock.com from Valerie Schreiner, who says, another great podcast indeed. The question of who's a Sherlockian certainly comes to my mind often. I was certainly aware of the stories growing up, but my interest, dare I say passion, did not come until my mid-20s. And by a modern character, admittedly inspired by Holmes in an interview with the creator. So, I began with the original stories, then to Brett, Rathbone, and even Robert Downey Jr., and Cumberbatch being my clear favorite. So I have often asked myself the same question. My answer? Well, I came to Holmes via a modern adaptation, and will gladly say that Cumberbatch is my Holmes, in the same way that Whovians have a preference to which is their doctor. but I do appreciate and enjoy the literary and scholarly works and read them with great interest, much like the others that have come to know and love Holmes via the modern adaptations. I had great welcome and enjoyment by being part of my local BSI Scion in Portland, Oregon, while I still lived in the U.S. They welcomed this new egg, and I reveled in the discussions and gatherings all related to our mutual interest in the great detective. That is how all Sherlockians should, and most likely do, interact. Now, living in London, it is a little piece of heaven to have a little bit of 1895 and my Holmes' world right outside my door. The gas lamp you reread is a great description of a Baker Street irregular and is what every Sherlockian should come to strive to be. Gladly, I can say that those I've encountered are. It appears to be a case of a few bad apples spoiling the whole bunch. Great, thoughtful podcast. Always enjoy them. Well, thank you very much, Valerie. That was, I thought, really well summed up.
Yeah, and thank you for writing so much and so thoughtfully about this. It adds a lot to the reason we do this really is for this kind of a dialogue and to have this kind of conversation going on, and it really helps us. And we had a comment from the Sherlock Holmes Enthusiasts group on LinkedIn from Beth Austin. I just listened to your podcast and do, in fact, have a couple thoughts. I came to the Sherlockian world between the popular surges. I was after the Brett series and well before the Downey movies, and this was before the rebirth of book groups, and I was in search of fellow readers. I confess I was actually in search of Janeites, but I could not find a group to suit me. I discovered the existence of Sherlockian Scion societies, and after trying out two of them, found a home with Watson's Tin Box of Ellicott City, Maryland. I was never made to feel inferior because I didn't know all there was to know about the Sherlockian world. As a matter of fact, the two founders took great delight in showing it to me and vicariously relived seeing it all for the first time. I eventually learned that there was a class system in place. Instead of fan and devotee, the divisive terms were Sherlockian and Holmesian. That's interesting, but that never touched my world directly. Holmes is for everyone. If he's not, then what's the purpose of keeping green the memory? Surely his devotees do not need help in that respect, but to bring in new fans, that's where Sherlockian Holmesian activity blooms. One of our members created an essay contest for seventh graders, the main object of which is to introduce young people to Holmes. We have a traveling evidence display that we exhibit in public libraries. We publish an annual journal of writings, art, poetry, and whatnot to share our enthusiasm. Our membership has grown from about 20 to over 30 per monthly meeting in the past year. Some of the new members are the uninitiated, and some have been knocking around the Sherlockian world for a long time. Both are equally welcome because both have contributions to make. As any teacher will tell you, that if you become a teacher by your pupils, you'll be taught. Our newbies help us see things differently. They ask fresh and incisive questions. Our old guard is mostly flexible and excited about the population explosion, welcoming new blood and new ideas. Bottom line, everyone can be a Sherlockian.
Well, those are great sentiments. Yeah. You know, I particularly like the line about, you know, if not, then what's the purpose of keeping green the memory?
That's right.
Boy. And then we've got another one that came in via email at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. This one comes to us from Lynn McDonald. Lynn says, "Hi, Mac. I've been missing the podcast and found this one particularly interesting. I read Phil Schreffler's article with considerable interest and amusement. He writes with all the indignation of an early churchman, dismayed that the hoi polloi have gotten their hands on a Vulgate Bible and have had the temerity to interpret it themselves. Indeed, he seems to regard the BSJ in much the same light as Holy Writ. I've been a Sherlock Holmes fan, I'm not sure that I can aspire to the lofty title of devotee, since I stumbled upon a copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes at the age of 12 and became hooked. The two-volume set were the first books I ever bought for myself. Since then, I've watched many TV and film Holmes with varying degrees of enthusiasm. When I heard that the BBC was producing a modernized version, I instinctively recoiled. Is nothing sacred? Upon viewing, however, I became, oh dear, that word again, a fan. I see no reason why loving the old and appreciating the new must be mutually exclusive. There's no doubt that much of the new Sherlock, quote-unquote, fandom lacks the eloquence of the old devotees, and admittedly, quite a bit of the online content is cringe-inducing. The pomposity of many of Mr. Schreffler's statements, however, inspire a few cringes of their own. Moreover, the fact that much of the online commentary lacks a formality of expression does not render its content worthless. At the end of the day, works of substance and value will endure no matter what their fashion or form. There's no need for Mr. Schreffler or anyone else to feel compelled to man the BSJ barricade and repel the barbarian invaders. Thanks again for your excellent podcast.
Lynn McDonald.
Well, do you have the boiling oil ready? I don't know.
From Daniel Pownall, entitled From the Hiatus Between Episode 50 and 51. Daniel writes, I've been a fan of Sherlock Holmes since I was first given the task as a 12-year-old to read the role of Holmes in my 7th grade English class. We read The Adventure of the Solitary Cyclist as a reader's theater, and the next year in 8th grade I read The Hound of the Baskervilles. I was assigned to read it for English class, and the teacher gave us a month to read it. And the class was given the assignment on a Friday. I had the story finished by Saturday afternoon. I was hooked. That was 1992, and I've been hooked ever since. Shortly after my reading of The Hound of the Baskervilles, I discovered the rest of the canon in Jeremy Brett's Granada series. And 21 years later, I discovered your podcast, and through you, the Baker Street Irregulars, their journal, and Wes Express. Hooray!
All right.
I subscribed to the BSJ. Hooray!
All right.
A few weeks ago, and I'm eagerly awaiting my first issue, I picked up a copy of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes from Wes Express and was amazed. A whole new level of Holmes reading was opened to me. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, and I looked for a local scion, and the closest I could find was 2 hours away in Tucson. I contacted the head of the group, and he said the local Phoenix scion disbanded a few years ago with the death of their group leader, and I'm now seriously considering starting a new scion in Phoenix. Any advice you could provide would be very much appreciated. Overall, I love listening to the show, and I'm very excited to start my journey into the scholarship realm of Holmes and Watson. Thank you for your podcast and opening the door for me to a deeper understanding and study of Sherlock Holmes, Daniel Pownall.
How about that?
Yeah, how about that? That's very gratifying.
And we know the head of the Sherlock Holmes Society in Tucson.
Oh, we do we? Who is that?
It's Bob Steck.
Oh, my God. I forgot he was out there.
Our old friend from Connecticut. He retired down in Tucson and really started the group up there and really lit a fire under things. So he's making an impact. Well, Daniel, if you can't find a scion that you'd like to belong to, you can always start one.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that. So those are a great handful of comments. We do appreciate those that have come in from a variety of locations. And again, just a reminder, if you would like to be in touch with us, our call-in line is 774-221-READ. Again, that's 774-221-7323.
You can send us an email, comment@ihearofsherlock.com. And Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter, you can find us on just about any social platform at ihearofsherlock. At Facebook and at Tumblr and at Twitter. So it's facebook.com/ihearofsherlock, ihearofsherlock.tumblr.com, and twitter.com/ihearofsherlock.
All right. And, of course, the recently established Sherlock Holmes community on Google+, we'll leave a link for that in the show notes. You can find it on ihearofsherlock.com, where, of course, you can also drop by and leave us a comment on each show's comment section. That network, by the way, that new community on Google Plus has really blossomed. There are almost 700 members at this point. Lots of categories there of discussion from on the web to the original stories and scholarship, pastiches, fan fiction, games, talk about Cumberbatch and Brett Rathbone, Robert Downey Jr., and lots of other modes to enjoy Sherlock Holmes. So, and there's even a spot there to find events that are going on, or put in your own society's events as well. So, a great way for everyone to rally around that person whose memory we look to keep green. Hmm. So, speaking of keeping green, and you know, we mentioned Edgar a little bit earlier. Last week, the Edgars were awarded in New York City. The Mystery Writers of America, of course, laud the best of the best every year with the Edgar Awards. And there were actually a number of Sherlockian publications or entities that were up for nominations. Under the Best Critical Biographical section, a nominee and winner was the scientific Sherlock Holmes, Cracking the Case with Science and Forensics by James O'Brien. Mm. Also in that category was a book edited by the aforementioned Otto Penzler called In Pursuit of Spencer, Mystery Writers on Robert B. Parker and the Creation of an American Hero. Mm. And then in the Best TV Episode Teleplay, there were two Sherlock-related entries. The first was the Child Predator episode of Elementary, of course, from the CBS television series with Johnny Lee Miller. And then A Scandal in Belgravia with the very Laura Pulver, who appeared on this show a few episodes ago, from the BBC Sherlock, and that one actually won the category.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And then it shouldn't go without mention that the Best Novel category, which was won by Dennis Lehane, was actually a category that also included A Baker Street Irregular. Our own Lindsay Fay of the Baker Street Babes. She was up for nomination for Best Novel for The Gods of Gotham, which was a mystery novel set in New York in 1845. It was the second work in her series after Dust and Shadow. Hmm. So congratulations to Lindsay for being nominated. I mean, what a tremendous, tremendous honor, and we are so proud of her.
Yes.
So that's what's going on in the news with the news of the Edgars. And then we exchanged a couple of notes over this, kind of a sad thing.
Oh, yeah.
Long-time Baker Street Irregular and reader of the Stand With Me Here on the Terrace remembrances of Irregulars who have passed over the Reichenbach before us, Irv Camel has passed away. Irv was 86. He lived in your neck of the woods, right, Bert?
Yes, yeah, I lived in New Jersey.
In New Jersey. Was part of the Cliff Dwellers, Mrs. Hudson's Cliff Dwellers. And had you known Irv for a long time, Bert?
Sure, absolutely. Well, yeah. It's very sad. You know, I think Bob Katz put it very well when he sent a copy of Irv's obituary around. Some people really are irreplaceable. Mm. And that was Irv. You know, he was a teacher. He was charming. He was erudite. He was fun. He was thoughtful. He will be much missed. And over the years, the part of the Baker Street Regulars annual dinner when he would step to the podium in the sad duty of recounting a little bit of the history of Irregulars who had passed and what they were noted for. Mm. And he did it gracefully and eloquently and painted lovely pictures of the people who'd passed, not all of whom were known to everyone in the room. And he did it very graciously, and it's very sad to think that next January we shall be doing that for Irv.
I know. That was part of the certainty of the work. I mean, with Irv up there doing that, we all knew that one day it would have to be done for him, but I don't think anyone was ready for it to be done so soon.
No.
And I know Francine Kitts, who took over that duty after Irv handed it off to her, is particularly aggrieved by this one. So Irv was a fantastic guy. And you know, Francine actually was the individual who was responsible for sitting down with Irv as part of the BSI oral history series and interviewing him. So, you know, at some point it might be nice to get Francine on to talk about her role as mundane and macabre as it might be, but also talk about some of the people that she's gotten to know over the years and the stories that they've told her.
No, that's a good idea.
Yeah. Cool. Well, before we move on to the main part of the show, because we did say this was about Sherlockian myth busting, I did want to give a quick nod to our sponsors. Of course, the Wessex Press. You can find them at wessexpress.com. Handy for all of your pressing Wessex needs. And, you know, every week we, or every episode, we try to take a look at the different sections there. And one stood out to me recently. If you go to the section over on the left-hand side of wessexpress.com, you see Wessex Press, Other Titles of Interest. And I thought to myself, self, what could those other titles be? And are they, in fact, interesting? Well, it turns out that they are.
You're kidding.
They are. They are. They do not do false advertising over there at wessexpress.com. You look at the top there, Dreams of Future Past, the science fiction of the worlds of Arthur Conan Doyle and H.G. Wells. Dana Martin Batory put that one together. That's one of the newer titles. Fascinating look at how the intersection of these two titans of the late Victorian, early Edwardian world come to play. Also, you know what? You have to move quickly here on West Express. You could have gotten the annotated Lost World, but it is now sold out. Sold out, I say.
Curse.
But.
Well, then I guess we'll never see it again. Is that right, Scott?
But you will.
Oh,
there is
kidding.
A new revised edition coming in the near future.
Impossible.
And our friend Roy Pilot, who just lives down the street from me a bit, is responsible for that. So forward to the Wessex Press bringing out the new edition of the annotated Lost World.
And if you wander over to bakerstreetjournal.com and explore that website, one of the things you'll find is that between now and June, and we're recording this on the 5th of May, but between now and June 2013, you can buy a copy of To Keep the Memory Green, Reflections on the Life of Richard Lancelin Green, the first joint publication of the Baker Street Irregulars and the Sherlock Holmes Society of London, for half price. That's $15, edited by Steve Rothman and Nicholas U. Tekin. And Richard...
That's a deal.
It is quite a deal. They discovered in moving to their warehouse a couple of boxes of this 2007 book. And for $15 plus shipping, it can be yours. So you'll find that on the website at bakerstreetjournal.com.
Interestingly, it's on the deal table.
Yes, amazing.
Excellent. So another thing there on the eBSJ... I'm not sure how many of you have the BSJ on CD-ROM. That is the historic archival version of the all issues of the journal through 2001 came out on CD-ROM. Well, if you take disc 4 of that CD-ROM and throw it in the direction of, I don't know the direction it needs to get mailed, but the information's there on, there's an order sheet on the page. Probably toward the direction of Zionsville, Indiana, I would imagine. You can be the proud owner of the new EBSJ on DVD. So rather than having four discs and having to swap each one out and looking through these PDFs of all the back issues, you will get one handy DVD with everything on it, including an update of the last 10 years or the 10 years since the first EBSJ was put out, all on that single disc. And you need, if you are a an existing owner of the CD-ROM, you have through June 15th to actually get that disc 4 in and claim your EBSJ for a $100 discount. So check it out before it's too late. And if you don't have the EBSJ CD-ROM yet, That's okay. The Baker Street Journal would be happy to sell you the EBSJ for $149.95. When you think about it, and I mentioned on the last episode about not getting volume one of the new series for $400, $150 for the entire run of 1946 to 2011 is a pretty good deal.
Yeah, very good deal.
Yeah. Now, moving into the section of our program where we talk about myth busting, this to the sponsors actually, because I just received a copy of the spring 2013 BSJ. Fantastic cover, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've gotten yours yes. yet or if you've seen the cover.
Yes, I've got it.
But it is an array of five villains. You've got Eric Porter as Professor Moriarty from the Granada series, and he's flanked by Lex Luthor, the Joker, Ernst Stavro Blofeld, and Fu Manchu. So just a really nice summary of the villains out there. And, of course, this is in reference to Kim Newman's 2013 BSI Distinguished Speaker Lecture, where he talked about what might have happened to Professor Moriarty, whose body was never found, by the way. That's always the thing with these villains. You know, when they're defeated, their bodies are never found. But in looking through the BSJ, there was a letter to the editor from one of our longtime listeners, Peter Calamai.
Oh.
You remember Peter said that he was recovering, this is probably 4 or 5 years ago now, recovering from either hip or knee replacement surgery. And he relied on our podcast to lull him to sleep. Which is why I don't listen to our podcast too much.
That's right.
I don't need to go to sleep.
It's better than Ambien. Just a few minutes of us and you'll be snoozing happily.
But in this issue, Peter raised a question that I thought was interesting, although I do have one issue with it. And if you go on the BSJ website, the issue that Peter raised is actually there because it's a challenge to readers. And there's a prize behind it. So Peter says, in her valuable and revealing article in the Winter 2012 BSJ, Validation of Internet Freedom, Christina Manente, a Baker Street babe, cautiously refers to, quote, the legend of Victorians marching along the Strand in black armbands, unquote, after the final problem was published. And Peter says, unfortunately, the use of the word legend is insufficient to signal readers that no contemporary evidence has ever been identified that anyone in London wore black armbands in public mourning for Holmes. Suggesting a march of armband wearers along the Strand is an unfortunate escalation of a story which is no better than a myth. In a letter in the Winter 2006 BSJ, Philip Burgum reported his own research into primary sources such as The Times, The Bookman, The Strand Magazine, and the John Bennett Shaw archives. He found no contemporary mention of black mourning bands. The earliest appearance of that Burgum could identify was in John Dixon Carr's The Life of Arthur Conan Doyle. He suggests that Adrian Conan Doyle may have foisted the tale upon Carr as part of his paternal myth-making. I have also looked at the Star, the largest circulation London evening paper at the time, plus some memoirs and autobiographies. Again, no evidence surfaced of black mourning bands. Yet, the myth will not die and is propagated by commentators, including several academics who either cite no evidence or refer to a previous publication which itself cited no evidence. I would like to challenge the readers of the BSJ to either put up or shut up. If there is contemporary evidence for black mourning bands being worn in public after Holmes supposedly plunged to his watery grave, then let's hear it. If not, then please stop over-egging the pudding. As Burgum commented, quote, the actual level of reaction is still quite noteworthy, unquote. So, what do you think of that, Bert?
My goodness, a myth. It's unbelievable.
A myth, a Sherlockian myth. And by the way, those who can find evidence, and we're helping to herald the call here for the BSJ. If you do have evidence, send an email to bsj.editor@gmail.com. Okay, so bsj.editor@gmail.com is where you should send any proof of the public getting their black armbands on and mourning Sherlock Holmes publicly. I do recall that, and I don't know if this is part of the myth or not, that a number of Strand Magazine subscriptions were canceled after the conclusion of the oeuvre of stories that comprise the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes. Of course, ending with the final problem. So, you know, it was another 10 years before Holmes made his reappearance in the magazine. So it's not out of the question that they may have lost readership. Hmm. So that is that's a myth needs busting, evidently. and it does remain a myth. Here's the thing, and what got me to thinking about making this our show topic. In this case, it's something that just worked into the popular lore. And it doesn't seem all that unlikely that it could have happened. You know, that's part of this. That it would not have seemed out of the ordinary for the public who were already writing letters to 221B Baker Street to think that Holmes actually died.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the character has been so popular and so much has been written that the line between written fact and popular myth has blurred. So let's try a couple of these things. In fact, let me try one on you. So,
okay.
True or
false. Let's bust some myths.
Bust some myths. True or false. The first words.
Wait. I got to get our Sherlockian Mythbuster music in here. Let's get ready.
You've got music.
Yes.
Excellent.
All right.
Okay, so here's one.
Now I'm ready.
The first words.
Yes.
That Holmes spoke to Watson are, "You have been in Afghanistan, I perceive." True or false?
This is a great one. And you know, I was presented with this question by a member of the Speckled Band years ago, Bill Singos.
Mm.
And I thought, well, of course, we all know that, right? Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, okay. You've been in Afghanistan, I perceive. That was the first thing.
Let me put the
Holmes
question
said.
To you. True or false?
I'm going to say true. Oh, no. You mean it's not true? We're
no.
busting a myth here?
No. The first words he said were, "How are you?"
Ah, well, he was cordial after all.
Well, that may have been. But what after-dinner drinks have to do with this is beyond me.
Indeed. Well, myth busted. Well, let me try one on you, Bert.
Oh, all right.
Everyone knows this one. Sherlock Holmes said, "Elementary, my dear Watson."
I think that is not true.
That is not true. Let's see. Let's go to the board. Is it true or not true? Is Bert correct? He is correct. It is not true. And why is it not true, Bert?
Well, because Holmes said elementary several times in the canon, but never elementary, my dear Watson. And he said my dear Watson, but he never put them together in a sentence.
You mean he couldn't string those two phrases together?
Well, he might have, but he never did in recorded fact.
Now, do we know where that made its first appearance?
Oh, I would say probably... on the movies or on the radio? In the movies or on the radio?
Yeah, I think it was the Clive Brook Sherlock Holmes in the 1920s, but I could be wrong. It certainly made its popular way into appearance in the Rathbone series, but it may have occurred in Wantner as well. It also may have occurred in the Gillette series.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, if anyone knows the answer to where that made its first appearance, let's clear it up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's go. You got another one?
Yes, I do. Christopher Morley, whose, by the way, birthday is today, May 5th.
Oh, happy birthday, happy, Chris Morley.
Said, never before has so much been written. I can't even retrieve the entire quote. Never before has so much been written by so many for so few.
Yeah, that's true. Right?
Yes.
Yes. He said that about not just the journal, but about Sherlockian scholarship in general as the journal was making its way toward publication.
Mm. And another popular fact, at least most people would testify to Sherlock Holmes, is that when Gillette cabled, the story is that Gillette cabled Conan Doyle to ask if he could marry Holmes in the version of the play that he was then working on. And Doyle replied, "You may marry him or murder him or do what you will with him or do what you like with him." I can't remember the exact word.
Yeah, do whatever you like with him, I think. Yeah. Well, that was really, is that true?
I believe it's true.
It's true. It is true. All right. And that was really progressive of Conan Doyle because gay marriage hadn't been discussed, you know, at all at that point. The fact that Gillette wanted to marry him, that was, well, I always thought that was a little odd for the time.
It's a hitherto unknown fact about William Jones.
That's great.
Mm.
Gillette married Holmes.
Yeah. Well, and Watson
that
was
is,
a
that
woman.
Is so myth busted.
Yeah, myth busted. So there you are. And then we get to the famous icons that are associated with Holmes, for example.
Oh, yes, of course. We know Sherlock Holmes. He's that guy in the funny hat.
Yes, the deerstalker hat.
Right. He wore one of those, right?
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, right. Oh, no. Busted.
Yeah.
But I thought I remembered a couple of Sidney Paget drawings where he's in Silver Blaze, they were out talking to Silas Brown, and they were in the first class rail carriage together, Holmes and Watson seated across from each other. I distinctly remember seeing that.
Well, the only headgear I think associated with Sherlock Holmes in the written words of Watson's records was an ear flapped traveling cap.
Oh, I see. That's my mistake. I guess I thought that Paget went along with them on their sojourns and was actually there to capture it like a court documentary artist.
Yes, like a court pasteller. Do you remember Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels? He had a camera that had a little imp in it. It was busily scraping away every time you had to take a picture.
That's great.
That's right.
Oh, so the Inverness cap, that's something of invention only by
Deerstalker,
Paget then,
right?
Huh?
The Deerstalker. Yeah,
Deerstalker, right.
Well, I think more of an invention by Walter because Paget used his brother Walter as a model, I think, most of the time for Holmes.
Well,
Here's another myth. Sidney Paget was the intended illustrator of the Sherlock Holmes stories in the Strand. True or false?
Well, I happen to know the story behind this one. That is, in fact, false.
Correct. It is.
Yes.
False.
And you started to give it away a little bit there, but his brother Walter was actually the intended artist. I guess there was something addressed to Mr. Paget, and they were either sharing a post box, a P.O. box, or it slipped under the door and Walter was still napping and Sidney grabbed it. But he got himself a commission there, and aren't we glad that he did?
Yeah. And the Inverness cape. We haven't talked about the Inverness cape.
Oh, yeah, the Inverness cape. That is, I'm gonna go with the Inverness cape. That, of course, Sherlock Holmes is iconic for the Inverness cape. Of course he wore an Inverness.
No, sadly, a cape-backed ulster.
Really?
Which is similar in the fact that there's a cape that goes over the shoulder, but it's not the traditional Inverness, which associated with its name, had its origins in Scotland and is of a different style altogether.
Well, who started that then?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I don't know.
Well, we'll have to do a little research. Of course, I know that the Inverness was never part of the original wardrobe. Because let's face it, if Holmes did wear the Deerstalker and the Inverness cape, he would have stood out like a sore thumb in Victorian England, you know, around the city. There's no one that would have not recognized him as he traipsed through the city with his silly hat and his cape. He's, of course, the original caped crusader. But and of course, clenched in his teeth at that very same moment was the classic curved meerschaum pipe, right?
Ooh, the curved pipe. Oh, I'll say just for the sake of argument, yes.
Oh, no. Bert, how could you?
Wrong again. Now, Holmes's pipes are well documented, to his cherry wood when he was disputatious, his black clay and so on, but as Chris Morley eloquently observed, a gooseneck. Gooseneck pipe was not for Sherlock Holmes, and doesn't appear in any of Paget's illustrations.
And I think the curved pipe was a choice first used by Gillette in the stage play because of two reasons. One, it was easier on the jaw to hold, as he had to have his hands free for other gestures and whatnot. And it also gave a clearer view of his face. Of course, the actors wanted to have the ability for people to see their handsome faces on stage. So that was part of it. But where that bulbous meerschaum first came from, I don't know.
Yeah, and also it's easier to speak your lines, I think, with the curved stem pipe.
Yeah. But I do remember, now that we're kind of putting all this together, the caped ulster, that was mentioned in that essay that you read for our Blue Carbuncle episode. Yeah. Morley mentioned that his father had an ulster that was turned into a dressing gown for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Other myths. Are there others that we wish to dispel or?
The Baker Street Journal is only for members of the BSI.
Well, if you're Edgar and trying to support Ben, retrospectively, yes, that is true. But no, of course, we know the BSJ is for anyone who wishes to take part in Sherlockian scholarship extraordinaire.
Correctamundo.
Of course, of course. Well, that's good to know. And of course, you can find lots of scholarship related to myths like this or not if you do subscribe to the Baker Street Journal and, of course, bakerstreetjournal.com. Thank you to our sponsors for making this segment of the show possible. Mm-hmm. Superb.
Good show.
You know, I don't know if I'll be able to do this as an extra this time around, but we can add it for the future because we are, I don't know if you're aware of this, Bert, but we are working on getting our Android app up and running for the show. Of course, people have been able to subscribe to I Hear of Sherlock for quite some time. I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere on iTunes. And we do appreciate you going to iTunes and giving us a rating, telling us what you think of the show, et cetera. That actually helps us become discovered by others. But we are working on an Android app, and it will be available at some point in the Google Play marketplace. But what that Android app will allow us to do is to put in some show extras. Some extras that are available only to subscribers via that app. And if it looks like that's successful, I think we'll create a parallel one for the iOS operating system as well. But what I was thinking for this time, if we can work it into this future app, there are a couple of videos that I found about Sherlockian myth-busting, about taking some instances of things that happened or were purported to and intrepid Mythbusters there, actually check them out, test them to see if it could happen in real life, and then make their conclusion. So Sherlockian Mythbusting for real.
Very good.
Yeah. Much more interesting than our little game show. But hey, here's an incentive. If you have some insight, some, you know, addition to what we just went through there as part of our little game show, if you can help us find where the Inverness first originated or where the Meerschaum first originated, and you can prove it, we'll do a little listener challenge of our own. We have some fine prizes here. We have Sherlock Holmes pens, which are marvelous. They look like the actual bust of Holmes there with the Inverness and Deerstalker. And, of course, we have back issues of the BSJ, so which we'd be happy to share with you. For those people that do contribute, that do send in comments or additions to that section of the show, we would be delighted to offer you your choice of prizes.
But rather than an editor's gas lamp today, since, as we mentioned earlier, we are recording the show on Christopher Morley's 123rd birthday, and Chris was, of course, the founder of the Baker Street Irregulars, Scott and I thought that we would look back on one of Chris's works. We had a lovely lunch in New York today, the start of a new scion. The Grill Partzer Club is part of the Hoboken Free State, which Terry and Linda Hunt are now working to convene on a regular basis in New York. And we had Bob Katz and Dick and Francine Kitz and Susan Rice and Mickey Frompkin and John Besh and Evie Herzog and Peter Krupe and a whole group of good folks gather in Manhattan today to mark this happy birthday of Morley. And looking back on someone like that who's still remembered is an opportunity to recall how unique and individual he was. He lived in a fascinating time. He was a magnificent writer. And as I look back on what I admire about Chris Morley, it's the defining characteristic of the sentiment that animated so much of his writing. And if you listeners don't know the writings of Christopher Morley, get thee to your library or to abebooks.com or to your local bookshop or your local bookseller and read some of his many volumes of essays and his wonderful poetry. And I wanted to read one poem, but also I can't resist starting with this poem, very short poem called The Secret, which Chris wrote earlier in his career. It was the house of quietness to which I came at dusk. The garth was lit with roses and heavy with their musk. The tremulous tall poplar trees stood whispering around, the gentle flicker of their plumes more quiet than no sound. And as I wondered at the door what magic might be there, the lady of sweet silences came softly down the stair. And that was compiled in a collection called The Rocking Horse that was first published in 1919. But many people who are familiar with Morley's poetry equate him with marvelous and intricate sonnets and his mastery of all the forms of poetry. And few people would relate him to someone like Ogden Nash. But he did later in life write a lovely poem called Tout le monde d'Escipient, which d'Escipient, you know, of course, basically means silly or foolish. But I like this poem very much because in this poem, he recounts a lot of his own experience in the world. So this is Tout le monde d'Escipient by Christopher Morley. In this life so slippery, dulce est d'Escipere. What are the joys of men? Enumerate them, then. Ink that runs from the pen and forms unbidden the desiderate word. Scraps of conversation overheard, swimming after sweat, driving a car, remembering the name of one unexpectedly met, the first cocktail at the bar, the first warm sun in March, collars without starch, finding a rare addition, the dawning dim suspicion, that dame likes me, I think we might go far. Making a full house from a pair, switching comedians off the air. Among the pleasures particularly man's are mushroom soup in cans. Old brown shoes well shined, the laughter hidden in the mind. Days when everything seems funny. The return of long-loaned money. Full appreciation of some art, whether hockey or hokusai. A bad cold nursed with rock and rye. Hitching the horse behind the cart, believing in your soul. The part is greater than the whole. The joy of being warm by firelight on a night of storm. Moonlight when it stipples. Long Island Sound in ripples. The footlights glowing on the curtain on a first night of your own. Remembering, though uncertain, a number on the phone. Books on which there's a hoodoo, because no one likes them as well as you do, or very few do. The fun that people miss by being prim and pris. Also the snags they strike by doing too much what they like. Morning papers and orange juice on breakfast tables, the almost vanished smell of livery stables, engines that go by steam, for pistons and cranks, oh Lord, my thanks. The curiosities of dream, an unexpected Valentine, spaghetti and red wine, hot towels at the barber's, tea and bread and butter in English arbors, falling asleep with a detective story, one that's both intelligent and gory. The feeling of a day when nothing has to be done, no appointments, absolutely none, just to loiter along the shelves, reintegrating all one's various selves. And then, when everyone's in bed, the silence overhead. His blue Morocco slippers donned. What evenings then had Toulamond.
Oh, that's just marvelous. And you know, in that very poem, I think we have almost the view of Morley as the man, that he is able to intimate everything from the mundane to the existential and everything in between. Mm. And that's the kind of guy that he was. You know, as I look at the gas lamp that Edgar wrote in the issue of the BSJ directly after Morley passed, one sentence stands out, and that is, Chris Morley was a man of so many parts that it is hard to count them. And I think that's well represented in the poem you just read, Bert.
Well, too, it puts me in mind, when William Gillette passed away, Freddie Steele wrote his obituary for the Players Newsletter, and one line of that I remember. I think it was towards the end, or it may have been the very end, when Steele observed about Gillette that he was a man who loved his life and who was sorry to leave it. And Morley, you know, was a great enjoyer of daily experience.
Sure.
Well done. Thank you. Well, I think that's brings us to the end, I believe.
Already?
Yes.
Oh, it seems like we just got here.
Well, let's do it all over again then.
Okay, we'll do episode 53. Well, this has been great. I think we covered a lot. We covered you know, where we were from episode 51. We got in words from our sponsors, of course, West Express and Baker Street Journal. Well, a little bit of fun and myth busting there, and challenge for our listeners, and a nod to the man who really got us all started here, Christopher Morley. So, what a nice show.
I can't wait to listen to it. You might want to listen to it.
No, I think I'm going to skip this one.
Well, that leaves me with nothing to say, but I'm Bert Wolder.
And I guess I'm the only one that has to say, I'm Scott Monty. And together we say,
The game's afoot.
Foot, yes.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.